broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon and many thanks to Mike Pryor for the last 2 hours. It's lunchtime, so time to talk about food and drink. So welcome to Flavour with Matt Bentman and Alan Alder.
Today we feature a new cider producer in Cambridge, how food pairings work, an evening of Korean food at a Cambridge University college, and the new beer garden by the can.
And on a sad note, the closing of Inda's Kitchen and why it happened. We'll be bringing you the local and university food and drink news as well, with our news section at the end and updates from Twitter during the programme. And we should mention too that this will be the only edition of Flavour this month. Details of what's on in our place at the end of the programme. It will be good.
First though, food pairings. There are some unusual ones about. If you go to Jack's Gelato in Bennett Street, you'll find gelato with combinations like Earl Grey and plum, rhubarb and rose, or lemon and basil. At Cambridge's Alimentum restaurant, there's roasted cauliflower with pomegranate and cocoa. But who thinks up these pairings? How is it done? Why do they work? And where can the home chef get ideas for unusual combinations? This is what I asked food scientist and blogger Dr. Sue Bailey.
Flavour pairings is quite an interesting area. It's probably most well known from coming from Heston Blumenthal with molecular gastronomy a number of years back now, in fact, and the idea of combining very weird things together. So, for example, he was trying to look at what would enhance the flavour of white chocolate. And he, first of all, tried smoked duck ham. I think it was some form of cured smoked duck with white chocolate. Then he tried seafood with white chocolate. Not so good. And then he hit upon caviar and white chocolate and found that actually worked really rather well. And he's come up with some similar exotic pairings ever since.
But how did he think to try caviar? It just seems an extraordinary combination.
Well, he went to see a flavour chemist. And this flavour chemist in Belgium, I believe, he suggested to him, this is the chemistry behind flavours. And they started to play around with some ideas together. And then this is where this all started from. So
right.
Very interesting.
What there are similarities in the chemistry of caviar
and white
chocolate.
Yes, that they're similar type of compounds that have the same type of, if you like, profile between caviar and chocolate, for example. Another one I read of was kiwi and oysters as a flavour combination. So some really intriguing ones. Vanilla and black pepper was another one as well. So he came up with quite a lot of interesting ones indeed.
To find out if a flavour combination works in practice, you're going to have people tasting them.
You are indeed. So you've got to get your guinea pigs lined up to taste these products. And obviously, if you're a chef, you can potentially do this because you will perhaps have a kitchen. Certainly, if you're Heston Blumenthal, he has a sort of test kitchen that actually works alongside his restaurant anyway. But if you're, say, a chef working in the area, you'll potentially be always playing around with different flavour combinations and ideas. And you may well go and look at probably one of the most interesting books, more for the sort of the normal consumer, the home cook, that's come out recently, a book by Nikki Senyet.
Flavour Thesaurus, yes.
Yeah. It's got some really clever ideas in it, hasn't it?
It has, although I get the impression with most of them that they are things that she has actually tried herself or come across herself in restaurants.
It's a very, very clever book because it makes you think, oh, well, what about that with that? Because obviously we don't all have the services of a nice, tame flavour chemist sitting next to us as we're chopping up and combining things together. But It's a very interesting resource. And there's another resource that I came across fairly recently, which is an online resource. And this is from a guy who had read about the Heston Blumenthal's pairings, thought, well, you know, what about the science behind it? He's actually a scientist by background. And so he has come up with this website, and it is called Food Pairing. Surprise, surprise. And you can actually access it for free, although obviously if you're doing more elaborate things, you have to pay for it. And so what he's done is look at the different flavour profiles of different foods and then work out, OK, what are the volatiles in those flavours and therefore what ones might pair or contrast well together. So it's quite an interesting thing.
Are there any cultural differences?
So yes, so for example, there's some research that was undertaken by one of our own homegrown researchers, who's a theoretical physicist and amateur molecular gastronomist. He's Sebastian Annett of Cambridge University. And what they did was analyse a whole range of recipes, I think more than 50,000 online recipes. And then they looked at them grouped into North American, Latin American, East Asian cuisines. And then they found some quite interesting research there that was comparing the flavour compounds. A lot of it obviously was data-driven. It wasn't actually getting people to taste these things, so it was from based from data. But they found that North American cuisine tended to prefer mozzarella, tomato and parmesan, which they all shared a very similar type of particular acid, for methylpentoic acid. And interestingly, he found that East Asian recipes actually very rarely shared any key flavour combinations. So it's this whole area of sort of pairing, contrasting, what does go well, what jars. And so obviously for something like an East Asian cuisine, it's often the contrast of sweet, salt, spicy, which gives you that sort of wow in the mouth.
The research into flavours and into, I mean, I'm particularly interested into flavour pairings. It's something that's more accessible to us at home. I mean, you mentioned chefs might have a test kitchen, but they've got to have people who are good at tasting, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
I mean, some people are more sensitive to taste than others.
Oh, indeed they are. Some people are much more sensitive to taste than others. This is where it's quite interesting to remember that smell and taste are two slightly different things. I mean, taste is actually a very basic sense. We only have five different basic tastes: sweet, salt, sour, bitter, and then umami, which is this sort of weird, slightly unusual taste, which is often, perhaps people suggest, it's enhanced by monosodium glutamate, but it's what often you've the taste that perhaps soy sauce is, that sort of interesting taste that was discovered in Asia about 40-50 years ago. So it's has been around as an identified taste, but in fact what often we call taste is actually smell. So our nasal receptors are actually incredibly sensitive. So this is when you get a cold, you really think, ugh, you know, food is just like eating cardboard and is really unpleasant. So interestingly, if you try and drink coffee with your fingers on your nose, all you'll taste is bitterness. You won't taste any one of the 10,000 different aromatic compounds. Similarly, try an onion with pinching your nose, and it just tastes sweet. You don't get any of that sort of amazing oniony, off-putting raw onion element that you would normally get. When you cook an onion, you know what happens. Some of the sweetness comes out. So it's this whole area much more of aroma than anything else that's really important. But to go back to your question about sort of chefs needing tasters, then yes, if they're very lucky, and I don't know whether or not there's any credibility to this, perhaps chefs themselves might be what's known as super tasters, because about 25% of the population are super tasters, so they're much more able to distinguish the subtleties of flavour.
How can you tell if you're a... Is there an easy test you can tell? Take a super taster, I guess, has a sort of a much greater density of taste buds in their mouth.
Potentially, what happens if you are actually testing people for taste panels, which are often used in the food industry, in fact. I mean, you don't use those, obviously, in normally in a chef setting, unless you're getting your friends around to taste dishes or you're getting people in the kitchen to do it. But in the food industry, you will have a lot of taste panels. And in order to screen people, firstly, you have to make sure, obviously, they're not sensitive to certain things. But then you do a check to see what levels of concentration can they taste salt or sweet. And then often that's beginning to pull out perhaps the super tasters, who are slightly more sensitive to, you know, very small gradations in sweetness and in saltiness. And then you then go on to train your panel, and then they become more sophisticated in being able to describe taste, for example, as well as able to be able to differentiate between the different types of taste. Yeah. But that can take 6 weeks or more, and it's an expensive process.
Yes. I can't help but wonder if people who are more sensitive to taste enjoy food more or less than people who are less sensitive.
Good question. I don't know.
But not everybody enjoys new food tastes, I guess.
Not everyone does.
So some of these combinations would be rejected by some people.
Oh, very much. I mean, there's what are known as food neophobics. And a food neophobic is someone who does not want to try anything new. Often it happens with children. They're often very often neophobic because, you know, oh, I don't want to taste it, but they've never tried it. So it's a bit of a sort of psychological thing with them. But with adults, again, it's the idea of they don't want to try new tastes, and they don't want to try new flavour combinations, new flavour pairings. So they would be the last people who would want to try any of Heston's wild creations. Yes. But the neophilics, the ones who love new tastes, in fact, would be more than happy to try those. And again, interesting research on this, which was looking at presenting, this was in America, presenting different types of salad dressings on a salad. And there were some more sweet, sort of more mango-y or vanilla-y tasting salad dressings. And then there are other ones that were chipotle, sort of smoky chili flavours, and I think more sort of spicy type of flavours. And it was, they found that the neophilics were the ones who liked the more spicy hot ones, whereas the neophobics were the ones that really preferred the sweeter ones. And weren't just not quite so adventurous, basically.
There's also, and I don't think we would have time to go into this now, maybe another time, but I think there's also quite a few people who are almost scared of food. You know, they know what they like and they'll stick to it, and they're just so wary of new flavours. They are very tentative when they taste something new, almost preparing themselves not to like it.
Yes. Well, it's interesting you should mention that. There's also another sense called the trigonal sense, or trigonal sense. And that's actually basically almost a sort of fear element that comes in. It's people who've tasted really hot chili will know exactly what I mean. And it's the bitter attack of almost the sort of assault on the senses. And I think people who don't want to try new foods, they've probably got a highly developed trigonal sensor, I would imagine. I don't know. I'll have to do some research on that.
Right. Well, thanks very much, Sue. That's really interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, that was a whole new world of food there. And that food pairing website really does sound like a good source of ideas.
Yes, it does. And thanks to Sue for finding it. It's got some really good, a lot of good ideas on it.
Yeah. Well, it's summertime and time at last to celebrate with some food and drink under the sun and by the river. The Thirsty Riverside Beer Garden is a Friday to Sunday venue, and it's over at the Museum of Technology. I went along last week to see what it was like.
Unique.
Only in Cambridge, really?
Yeah, only in Cambridge, yeah.
How did we find out about this place? It was James, wasn't it?
We're local residents.
Thirsty opened a place around the corner from us. It was very successful, and they've opened this place up.
Feels like what a beer garden should be.
It's such a good idea.
For me, that's kind of like a bonus, because I just like the atmosphere of them trying to do something different.
We're big beer fans, so we do travel far and wide looking for our beers.
Someone from work told me, actually.
Who from work? Was it Dave?
No. I was like, was it Dave from work? And I'm like, I don't know a Dave from work.
I don't either. But I do know a Sam. Sam Owens has been running Thirsty, a beer and wine shop on Chesterton Road, for 18 months now. I went to his first Thirsty Fest last year, the food and drink celebration. And he's at it again. With this, his latest venture, the Thirsty Riverside Beer Garden.
What gave you this idea? Well, you know us, Matt. We've done those events over in Bodyworks, and then we did the Christmas Thirsty Fest in Mackay's car park, and we like putting on these things in places where you wouldn't normally expect to find them, getting some great drinks and some great food and having a really good old laugh.
I came here on the first Friday night and it was absolutely rammed.
Sam, it's quite left field to think, oh, set up a bar here, but do you fancy doing this? And I'm like, yeah, we do.
It's a mini festival.
Yeah. They're all reacting to the sun. The sun has just finally poked through those clouds.
This lady's from South Africa who's come over here. This is Jill.
Nice to meet you. I'm not from South Africa, but this is my accent. Is it very good?
Yeah. Where are you from?
Johannesburg.
Johannesburg?
I commute here every day.
This is Thursday Riverside on a Sunday afternoon.
We never, never in a million years anticipated quite the volume of people.
And the setting's perfect, and it's great to just have this experience near the river.
Seems pretty awesome at the moment in Cambridge.
I love it, they told me.
Yeah, yes, very much.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a good place to come.
Have you tried any of the food here yet?
Yes, so today we have provenance here, and they have an amazing bratwurst, which goes very well with the beer. And I'm following that with some great chai latte from the coffee vendor.
I mean, half of the food trucks now is seeing the skyline, this one from San Diego. I mean, it looks like it's from the 50s. Looks like the kind of thing my insane uncle in North Dakota would have in the case of a nuclear explosion, you know what I mean?
So you get a variety when you come here, you know, you'll always have coffee or something, and there'll always be some street food.
I'm not from Spain, but I lived there 10 years, so it was nice to see familiar food very close to us in here.
They do have a very good selection, really good selection.
There were queues like going down out of the venue.
It's a very natural setting, right? Like you're walking along the river and then you find a very nice place full of people with beer.
You're in a good place, Cambridge. It's a lovely city. Me and Loz always sort of say there's never been a better time to be into beer, because it's incredible the explosion in sort of beer and craft beers and stuff in the last few years. Well, tonight I'm gonna drink
till I get my fill. So today we got Erdinger Weissbier from Bavaria, the Hofbräu Dunkel Weissbier, so a darker wheat beer, also from Bavaria. And then we got a couple of beers from Redwell in Norwich. We got their Steam Lager, which is a slightly darker style of lager, a little bit more flavour. And we got their New Zealand Pale Ale.
I actually had the German Weissbier.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the Erdinger Weissbier, which was very good, as you can see by my empty glass and cup.
I'm sipping from a New Zealand Pale Ale, I think.
I don't actually normally drink ale. I'm normally a cider drinker, but I feel at a beer garden you have to try out the beers. And yeah, it's good. It's very good.
Are there any particular drinks that are proving really popular today?
All the beers.
Yeah, the Pale Ale's been selling pretty well.
So we've got a West Coast Pale Ale, and then we've got a sort of juicy sort of pale ale, 5.5% and 4.5% sort of percent. So both excellent.
And a Club Mate, which is like an iced tea energy drink. And we've also got a Fritz Lemon, which is like lemonade.
But we said it's quite good for the other local businesses as well, that actually when they have the overspill here, they tend to go to one of the other pubs, which is like locally run, the Haymakers, the Green Dragon and places.
Yeah, because what they're saying, the Haymakers made more than...
The Haymakers made more than they've ever made since they opened.
On opening night.
On the opening night here, and I think that's all kind of overspill.
Yeah, it's really good.
I've just stuck to the...
the rosé.
Rosé, a bit traditional. Might be a bit more...
We should have gone for the bottles. So.
Yes.
But there's only two of us, so yes. We can't.
I think today is definitely a Sunday vibe. Everything's a bit slower today. People are trickling in, but constantly, and everyone's pretty relaxed and enjoying the sunshine.
There's quite a lot of people here. All the tables are really packed quite closely together, and all the tables are full.
So Ellen, the Museum of Technology, your favourite place in Cambridge?
Yes, I think it always has been.
I approached the guys here from the museum in January.
Yeah.
Asked them if they were up for us getting involved and coming along and organising something during the summer.
I was saying to Emily earlier, it's something that's completely aside from the university and the Cambridge that everybody knows. It's nice to have something different and that kind of Victorian architecture and something that's away from... It feels more like it belongs to the town. Because I cycle a lot, whenever I bike up by the river, when you come back into Cambridge, as you turn a point into Chesterton, the chimney's the first thing you see.
This is for family parties as well.
It's like a play area, isn't it?
I was half expecting it to be full of students when I got here, so I'm surprised it's such a diverse crowd. It's fantastic.
You know, you see the children playing here, families arriving, older people.
Young people and then us in our 70s.
Yes.
It's great.
Yeah, a cross-section of the community coming together.
I know people from work went last weekend at the Long Bank Holiday and they were saying that space for the kids up there was really great as well. So they brought along some of their kids who were like running crazy in the back bit, and they said it was nice because they could have a drink, sit down and know that their kids are kind of contained in a relatively safe space, just running around having a bit of fun as well.
I mean, to be honest, I want to be a kid now.
There aren't many places. I mean, I've got kids who are 6 and 8, and if you go out, you know that it's always a struggle to keep them occupied, and you want to have a nice bit to eat, a nice drink, but you've always got to be worried about the kids. So here, it's away from the road, it's away from the river, run around and have a great time on the hammock.
Oh, there's a hammock in it. That's nice.
Great time with the toys.
Fairy lights out by the river in the evening.
It's good.
Some chilled out music. It's make it family friendly. Walking your dog, come on in.
Bella, are you ready?
Ready.
It's a dog-friendly site as well.
Yep,
yeah, it is. Yeah, they've been promoting it. That, you know, bring your children, bring your dogs. We had a cafe last year in like a medieval barn, and we made a big thing of, you know, it was family-friendly, it was dog-friendly, and it's great. It's a great vibe.
Yeah.
This is Firsty Riverside on a Sunday afternoon.
It's Caroline's birthday.
Hooray!
And you celebrated by coming to Thirsty Riverside.
We did. We thought, what better than a birthday beer garden? We've had a great time. We've been here a few hours.
And you tried lots of the German beers, of course, yes?
Absolutely. Yeah. And bratwurst and some really great food. Yeah.
Some good sauerkraut and lamb.
Andy and Hannah of the Rural Coffee Project. You've been cleaned out today.
We can't believe how many cakes that we're selling here, actually. So we sold out our cakes about 2 hours ago. We should have renamed ourselves the Rural Cake Project. But we've still got coffee going, we've still got tea going. Then we've got the South African street food just starting up. People can move on to that. It's tea time now, so street food and a pint of beer and last few orders on the coffee before we pack up and head home.
Yeah, and I quite like that they're doing different things with it. So I read online they're going to do like enchanted cinema. And...
I didn't hear that.
Oh, did you not? Yeah, no, I was reading it earlier actually on the Museum of Technology's website.
Open air cinema, yeah, enchanted cinema. We're going to have a couple of weekends showing various different films. Watch this space, we'll get the dates up on the website in the next few weeks. We're also looking to hold some farmers markets up here. The museum held an event last October in the Pumpkin Festival, a farmers market, so we're going to be looking to hold those every month starting in June.
Is it true?
It's true, I just found
Yay!
Out. And he said there's going to be farmers markets here as well in collaboration with the museum. I'm happy now.
Yeah. There you go. You learn a little something. Yeah.
So overall, you're happy with this weekend?
Yeah, that's been great. And I think first weekend, last weekend, the bank holiday was just bonkers. Knocked a little bit sideways, to be honest. But this time, this weekend, it's just been a really nice, steady, constant flow and you know, a normal weekend, a school weekend, if you like. People have just been so positive about it. And that's lovely, because we just want to make this thing a great event this summer.
A bit off the wall, street food, nice beers.
Lovely music.
Nice music.
Yeah.
Nothing too traditional, something no. Cambridge.
Yeah.
Thirsty Riverside will roll on all through to September.
Dankeschön. Prost.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. With a steady supply of Thirsty's own beers and ales on tap, wines and soft drinks, street food vans this weekend feature the Rural Coffee Project, that's all weekend, Shoestopper with his amazing profiteroles this evening, along with Fired Up Pizza and Honest Burgers. Then on Sunday there's Reggae Kitchen, Al Chili and Provenance Kitchen. All beer garden information is available on their Twitter feed, that's at Thirsty Cam, and Cam with a B.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and
report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
Coming up in a few minutes on Flavour, we've got something about the sort of development of the supper club idea that's taking place at Robinson College. And we speak with Inda Bull of Inda's Kitchen about their closure. First, though, and continuing the subject of drinks, cider is a drink that's grown greatly in popularity in the last few years. And it's attracted some good new independent producers too, who make much more interesting cider than the mass-produced brands. And now a new cider maker is supplying Cambridge pubs. It's Graham Creech, who has opened the rampant Meerkat Press, and I asked him about it.
All of my cider is apple juice, which is left to ferment naturally, which is different from most mass-produced ciders. The apples can come from a variety of sources, but at the moment I'm trying to keep to single varieties. So at the moment I'm producing a lot from russet, which is different from certainly West Country cider is cider-specific apples.
Russet has quite a distinctive flavour, so that means the cider has quite a distinctive flavour.
It does, yes. It's definitely different from a West Country cider. In the east of England, traditionally, cider's been made with eating apples, but not, as far as I know, russets. It started as a hobby. I've been making it for 9 or 10 years now with various apples, depending on what supply I could lay my hands on. It's changed over that time, and people know that you have you make cider and they have spare apples, so your supply changes. But it's very much, the interest is in not adding any sulfites or chemicals to the cider and just letting the natural yeast do its
right,
thing.
So when you talk about them fermenting naturally, it's natural yeast, you're not adding any yeast.
Yes, it's all entirely natural yeast from the skins of the apples, and I think by now from yeast that has chosen to live around my equipment.
Yeah.
So everything is sterilised before I start. The apples are washed but not sterilised, and there's enough yeast on the skins to produce that fermentation.
Right, so it's the drink equivalent of sourdough bread then.
Yeah.
You say you don't add sulfites. Why are sulfites added?
The sulfites kill yeast or kill any organisms in the apple juice. So if you want to control the type of yeast that is producing your cider, you drop sulfites in it at the start of the process, and then you add yeast from a sachet to start that fermentation. You can also add sulfites during the process to produce a sweet cider, or at the end just to definitely complete the fermentation. But at that stage, the taste is fixed and no further fermentation will take place, so that the taste won't continue to develop.
Right, so and with yours, the yeast stop working because...
The yeast that produce the alcohol, they have a choice of two ways to die, neither of which are all that pleasant. They either starve or they poison themselves with the alcohol.
Right. Okay, and is that the end of the process then?
There's a longer fermentation called malolactic fermentation, which develops the flavour over a longer period of time.
Well, after the yeast have packed it in?
Yes, yeah. Once the yeast, the alcohol fermentation takes perhaps 3 or 4 weeks and it's more or less complete, the taste will continue to develop over months after that, up to 6 or 9 months, possibly longer. I'm not sure any of mine has lasted that long.
What sort of length of time are you aiming at for these secondary fermentation?
The apples that I juiced in October and November last year are now ready to drink. It will continue to develop from now.
And how alcoholic are they?
That varies as well, based on the yeast and the sugar content. The latest batch was 9%, which surprised me. Typically less than that, so maybe 6 or 7%.
Wow. So the yeast could stand 9%, so they're quite robust yeast.
Yes, yes.
In your house.
They seem to be, yes.
Yeah. Right. And where are you getting apples from then? I mean, as you go into bigger production, you're not always going to get ones from people's gardens or allotments or whatever.
Exactly. It's changed over the years from a few kilos here and there from a variety of trees to people who have a few trees in their garden, then scales up slowly. The reason I'm selling it this year is to get a feel for how popular it might be so that I can scale up again. And I have a friend who has a apple farm. So all of their apples are destined for the supermarkets, and they have to look perfect, which means that any that don't look perfect or ripen at a time when before the pickers arrive or after the pickers arrive, aren't any use to his production. So there's a field of apples which are left for the birds, unless I come along.
It's very nice to know they're being used and not wasted. How can we get your cider? What outlets have you got?
At the moment, I've sold some to the Cambridge Blue. I need to deliver some to the Live and Let Live. I've contacted some other local pubs.
And I guess it's not bottled, is it?
Not yet, because it's just in the process of being set up. I'm waiting to see what form people would like it in.
And what's the name of the cider?
It's the Rampant Meerkat Press.
Why the Rampant Meerkat, then?
Two reasons. The Meerkat is my interpretation of the German word Gemütlichkeit. My wife's German. Gemütlichkeit means cosy time. And it's sung in beer festival songs and so on. And it's our shorthand for a cosy time now is meerkat, log fire on and raining outside or so on. And the Rampant is from a printing press in Cambridge, the Rampant Lions Press, which was a fine printing press that ran for a few decades in Cambridge, run by a father and son. They had an exhibition at the Fitz Museum recently, and that inspired the name of the press. Not a printing press, but a cider press.
Great name. Thanks very much, Graham.
And that was Graham Creech. Rampant Meerkat Press ciders can be found at the Cambridge Blue in Gwydir Street and the Live and Let Live in Mawson Road, with more to come, we hope. And that music, of course, signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, three quickies. The old bicycle shop in Regent Street has Parmesan seed and squash scones on its afternoon tea menu today. Steak and Honour are at Burwash Manor until 3:00. And a new cafe has opened at the Newnham Bakery in Derby Street. And the bakery is now doing artisan breads too.
Lovely. As we reported 4 weeks ago, Inda's Kitchen, which had established a big following for its curries, has closed down. It came as a shock to us all, and its founder, Inda Bull, has given an exclusive interview to Flavour.
Inda, I think Inda's Kitchen started about 6.5 years ago?
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
And now there's a sign on your website saying, unfortunately, we have now ceased trading. And I know a lot of people have been shocked by that, and I wonder if you could say something about why that happened.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the first thing to say that I'm actually very humbled by, you know, people's reaction. I think people have been genuinely quite sad and quite shocked, and that's been quite humbling to know that at least, you know, while we were trading, we brought perhaps a little bit of pleasure to some of the residents of Cambridge. So that's been really nice sort of feedback. But essentially, we needed to scale the business. We were really at that kind of crossroads.
Meaning
we'd obviously changed our direction somewhat over the last sort of 12 to 18 months and gone more into manufacturing rather than doing the hot delivery. So obviously the sort of the chutneys and the ready meals, which obviously you're familiar with, and more recently the curry kits. And they were now sort of in about 40, 45 stores and outlets, including Budgens, in and around Cambridgeshire. And we'd also sort of been talking to Nisa Local. We'd got a deal with them. And we were also talking to people like the Co-op in East Anglia and also Ocado. And the reality was is that we needed really just a huge injection of cash to realise those types of accounts, because, you know, when these guys order, they order big, and someone's got to front that money and has also got to find, you know, the cash to put all the marketing and the promotional sort of expertise and input into it, and we just didn't have that kind of money, and we tried to raise it. We went to our bank for help, and unfortunately, you know, we ran out of road, so we had to make some very difficult decisions, but that's the reality of what happened. So it was quite sudden.
You couldn't have just kept going in a smaller way, carried on as you had been for the.
I think we probably could have, but really, you know, I think people's perception really of Inda's Kitchen was that we you know, we were doing incredibly well and had loads of money, and you know, and that's not the reality really of a lot of small businesses, not just sort of Inda's Kitchen, but there's an awful lot that goes on behind the scenes, which is a lot of work and a lot of sacrifice and just really stretching cash flow. So, and if we had bad periods, say over the summer or over Christmas, when, you know, curry generally was always very seasonal, you know, those times kind of hit us quite hard. So I think if we'd carried on, you know, without sort of any financial kind of cushion, I think we would have got ourselves into a bit of a mess. And what I didn't want to do was carry on and then get, you know, another month, 2 months down the line, not be able to pay staff for what they'd done for us. And so for all of those kind of moral reasons, we pulled the plug. We pulled it pretty quickly because we tried desperately hard right up until the end to try and, you know, find a way to carry on. But you know, it's we ran out of road, and we had to do and wanted to do the right thing by our staff. So that's where our final pennies went.
No. But when you first started, I mean, you very, very quickly took off, didn't you? There were lots of plaudits from Cambridge foodies, you know, the ones we all know who they are.
Yes.
And, you know, this is the extraordinary achievement of getting into the top three in the BBC Food and Farming Awards as well. So it is a shock for people. is it a shock for you? Or did you see it coming? I suppose you must have.
Well, yes and no. I think we were very aware that if we didn't raise the money that we needed to raise to really take that next step, then something drastic had to happen. So, but even then, because we've put so much into the business, you know, we just believed that we would find a way. So it was a bit of a shock. It wasn't easy, but for all the reasons I've already said, you know, it was morally, it was the right thing to do.
Mm. What about the Cambridge food scene? I mean, since you started, it has changed, hasn't it? It has grown.
Yes.
So there's greater competition.
I mean,
perhaps not for curries, but for other sort of quality, independently produced food.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, really. I think when we started, we were, you know, essentially an e-commerce site. So just the way in which people ordered their food, sort of basically like an online shop, put it into a basket, and then, you know, booked into a half an hour slot, which we would then battle through, you know, Cambridge traffic and try and honour to the best of our ability. And that was very innovative, sort of 6.5, 7 years ago. And actually, moving from London to Cambridge, I think we were quite surprised as to really just... There's lots of chains here, but there weren't really very many sort of quality independents. So I think we made our mark very early because we did stand for quality and convenience. And so I think people who really appreciated good food, of which there are very many people in Cambridge, took to us really, really quickly. You know, and I think now that the food scene is very different, it is more competitive. There are lots of fabulous, you know, independents out there. The kind of street food scene has taken off, and they care about their food, and it's always of such an exceptional quality. And then I think really the advent of sort of Deliveroo and delivery organisations like that, I think, hit us quite hard, because whereas we were innovating in the early days and providing, you know, a very convenient delivery service of quality food, along come Deliveroo, and they do exactly the same, but it's not just curry, you can have pretty much what you want. And so the face of kind of home delivery changed very dramatically, and that affected our home delivery business quite significantly. And it wasn't the only factor, because obviously we wanted to change direction, but it was a factor in making that decision.
Right. When the scene changes, like with the advent of more street food, the advent of Deliveroo and similar organisations, you've got to change direction. You've got to be fast on your feet. Yeah. And what you're saying is it costs.
Yeah, it does, because, you know, although we'd already started to sort of sell and manufacture sort of our ready meals and the chutneys and the curry kits were sort of, you know, on the drawing board at that time, you know, essentially we pretty much kind of almost went back to being a startup by losing sort of the hot delivery. And, you know, we weren't a startup as, you know, blank sheet of paper startup. Let's just create something. We had products, we had a portfolio, but, you know, the focus then changed because our revenue was coming from, you know, stockists and selling through retail. And we did offer our frozen food direct to customers, but I just don't think it really worked. And I think, you know, food is instinctive and it's, I fancy a curry, let's get one tonight. And I think ordering frozen food online is normally something you just buy to stock up your freezer. It's not as impulsive. So the buying patterns were different and it was just a slower burn.
So you probably lost a few of your customers.
Yes.
Because you changed direction, although you gained others.
Yes, yeah. I would say so.
So what does it mean to you personally then? You've put a lot of hours in.
Yeah, I have. I've put a lot of hours in. And, you know, I look back now and, you know, I'm really glad we did it. It was a huge passion of ours. And we, you know, we can't look back and say, well, we just never gave it a go. It had its highs and it had its lows. But, you know, I feel now that we're sort of now looking to sort of move our lives on. You know, I've learned a hell of a lot. And now I'm back in the sort of, you know, employment market. And, well, there's transferable skills, you know. But you know, a lot of it is true. There are things that I've learned in the last 6 or 7 years, which I think will stand me in good stead for whatever I do next.
Right. Have you learned anything which you can pass on to anybody listening who might actually be thinking of setting up their own food business?
Absolutely.
Have you got any advice for them?
I think just, you know, it's a lot of hours. I mean, food, catering, hospitality it's unsociable hours. So having my Friday nights back even now sort of feels like a novelty, you know, because for 6.5, 7 years, I was never home on a Friday night. I'd be working. So just be aware that it's a lot of hours and a lot of it is unsociable. It's weekends, it's evenings. On the plus side, I would say, you know, if you're passionate about something, you know, you should absolutely go for it, you know. So definitely that. And really, I think just kind of make sure financially you can make it work, because at the end of the day, the old saying of cash is king, it really is true. I think one of our biggest stresses really was just coping sometimes with sort of the financial anxiety of how the business was going to do. And you just so depend on other people liking your product and buying from you. So if that, for whatever reason, falters, then the knock on is obvious. But I mean, do it, but you know, just go in knowing that it's a risk. And you know, I'd get some advice from people maybe who've done it before, and yeah, and just be fully, you know, just go in with your eyes open.
Perhaps you could be a consultant.
Maybe I could.
But what next? People still want your curries, you know.
Well, it's funny because I've just heard from a dear friend, actually, who Toby, who runs the Blue Ball, and he's just keeps saying, come and cook. And it is very tempting. And I kind of wonder whether I should do a kind of a farewell something. But at the moment, to be honest, our priorities are just getting ourselves back on a cash-in basis, you know. And and I think once that sort of side of things has all settled down, then I might do something. I mean, I still love food. It's not a chore for me at all. We need to steady the ship on a personal level, and then maybe we'll have a little bit of fun. You never know. I might pop up somewhere.
Right. Well, we hope you do.
Thank you, Alan.
Inder, thanks very much indeed.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Ta. Well, a sad end, but be sure, if Inder does make an appearance at the Blue Ball or anywhere else, we will let you know.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And Ema O'Hanlon's just come into the studio. Hello, Ema.
Hello.
Are you on exams at the moment?
Not quite yet, nearly. Right. We've got about 2.5 weeks left.
Oh, OK. Anyway, Ema's come in to do the university food and drink news shortly.
And on the subject of food and drink news, the supper club scene in Cambridge has died down in the last 2 or 3 years. They've taken enormous amount of work to put on and involve not a little stress. However, they are greatly missed by followers, and maybe there is a new format which will take their place. So here is Alexis Moreau talking about the forthcoming Korean evening at Robinson College in Grange Road, beginning with what's on the menu.
We will be starting the dinner with what we call a bosam. So the meat option will be a slow-cooked pork. And then it's a little bit like a Chinese crispy duck pancake. Therefore, you've got a slow-cooked pork, and then you wrap it up in baby jam. And it's kind of, you know, you pick it up and eat it with your fingers.
So it's quite a relaxed way of eating. It is
absolutely. What we will be doing will be that bringing all the ingredients on the table, and people will be able to actually make their own starter themselves.
And I think you're aiming, I mean, not for a sort of a formal and perhaps rather stuffy evening. I think you're aiming for something quite different from that, aren't
Absolutely.
You?
What we've kind of launching a series of themed evenings, and what we want to try to say to people is that, yes, we are a college, but what we want to tell them is that we want to create a bit of a very informal evening when there is some interaction between the customer or the chefs as well. Therefore, the chefs will be in hand helping with the starter, for example. They will be also around during the dinner to direct people to the buffet for the main courses. So there will be an opportunity to speak to the chefs about the ingredients, the flavors, you know, how they made the dishes. And also there will be some interaction with people during the evening talking about the Korean food. Yes, we are going to be doing as informal as possible for people to feel as relaxed as possible during the evening.
Yes. So it's quite educational as well.
I think it will, yes.
Seems very fitting. The bosam, and you mentioned the pork, but there's a vegetarian alternative.
There is also a vegetarian bosam. So it's it will be made exactly in the same way. We've wrapped up in the baby jam, and then it's kind of a crispy leaf that you know, it's gonna be handmade by the customer as well. So
right, and then there's a soup.
There is a spicy miso and shiitake soup. So a clear soup that will be more like a palate cleanser to then move on into the main courses, because there will be a choice of free meat main courses and fish main courses, as well as a vegetarian option. They will be served from a buffet style. Therefore, there will be the interaction with the chefs, but also people can have a little bit of everything or more than another if they wish as well.
Okay, so what sort of things are going to be available?
So you're going to have what's called a makagali jim. So it's braised beef short ribs in sweet soy marinade. There will be some spicy stir-fried squid and also some crispy tofu. And the vegetarian option will be a vegetable pigeon. All of this will be served with bibimbap and kimchi.
And dessert?
Dessert, there will be... It was a very, very interesting, because Korean desserts are not very... kind of well-known, but also we haven't got a large selection of options. So we will go for a Korean rice pudding with lychee, melon and persimmon salad, so that's called ozinga, and there will be also an option for lemon tart.
That must make matching, because I know you're doing matched wines, that must make that quite a challenge. How did you go about choosing the wines?
Well, absolutely, you're right. I got in touch with Alice Archer from Cambridge Wine Merchants, who very kindly agreed to work with us on that evening. And she mentioned that the Korean cuisine is very robust and full of flavour. There is a lot of saltiness and spiciness and sweetness and sour all together. So it makes the matching quite complex. But she advised that she would definitely be going down the route of advising for a New World Cabernet Sauvignon. So it's quite a rich, rich, deep red wine, as well as probably a Southern Italian white, such as pungent whites, or even going down the route of a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc as well. So interesting flavours with quite deep wine as well. So that should be a good match, I think.
This is part of a series then, this Korean night?
Absolutely, Alan. It's been on the agenda for quite a while. And we've got the Korean evening coming up in June. And the next one will be a Greek extravaganza at the end of September. So we've got to finalize all the details. But it's something that we are very keen at doing within the college. And it's something that, as we mentioned earlier on, we want to invite people to the college, and telling them that it's not going to be a formal sit-down dinner. It's really an interactive evening that people can have a little bit of fun. They will be able to try new dishes and maybe flavors that they are not used to. With an interaction with our own chefs, and obviously in a brilliant location. That's what we're trying to aim.
Well, it sounds a bit like a development of a supper club.
You're absolutely right. And the vision that we had a few months ago was that, how can we take the supper club element in terms of going to somebody who's keen on having a nice evening with some people that people don't really know, on how can we take it to the next level in terms of scale. So our idea for the first Korean evening is it would be great if we could reach 50 guests, but maybe for the Greek extravaganza, you know, increasing the number would be fantastic. So it's really taking the supper club to the next level.
Yes.
I think he worked very well a few years back, and it seems like it could have... I think people are still interested by supper clubs, so that's what we're trying
yes,
to do.
Yes, people miss them because there aren't very many anymore, so this is a really nice development. Okay, so this Korean one is what's coming up next, and you said that's on the 8th of June.
The Korean evening is on the 8th of June, so at Robinson College in Cambridge. Start at 7 o'clock with a reception where we will be serving an interesting Korean soju. So the Korean soju is the most popular Korean alcoholic beverage, and it's traditionally made from rice, wheat or barley. It's a clear alcohol. It can be quite strong. Traditionally, they drink it as a shot. But what we've decided to do is we're going to serve it as more of as a longer drink. So there will be some option with adding elderflower and citrus. But also we're probably going to do a mojito style drink for a longer drink, very refreshing. So the evening start at 7 o'clock. Then we, after the reception, we go on to the sit-down meal. And it will be £37.50 per person, including the wine.
That sounds very reasonable.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much, Alexis. Thank you. Well, that all sounds pretty exciting to me. And they have good experience at Robinson of Korean food. They've been putting on private Korean functions for some time, so it's in good hands. The chefs have plenty of experience of it. Now, to book, you go to the Robinson College website and then click on conferences and then on dine, and you'll see the details on the page. I think it's a really good idea, and I think the Greek one in September is one to look forward to as well.
Hmm. Booker T and the MGs taking us into today's food and drink news, beginning with the latest from the university scene. And of course, Emma Hanlon is here. Welcome back into the studio.
The programme of university to society events is sparser than usual, owing to the fact that it's exam term and everyone seems to be in revision mode. Nevertheless, there are a few events worth taking in if you have the time. The Cambridge University Wine Society will host a Burgundy tasting in the Uni Centre bar next Tuesday, May 16th at 8 p.m. Tickets went on sale last night, so do get one soon from their website if you're interested. Their events have all sold out so far, so it's worth booking now if you don't want to miss out. There will be no Tea Society meeting this Sunday, as the Society will be leading a walking tour in London in conjunction with the Oxford University Tea Society to take place on May 14th. They will be visiting a selection of tea shops, including Twinings, East India Company, as well as the tea cafe Yumcha, for samples and the opportunity to buy lots of loose leaf tea. Their normal weekly meetings will recommence next week. If you're a student at Emmanuel College, you're in luck. The welfare officers are holding a couple of events involving food over the coming weeks. Today, from 3 to 5 p.m, there will be tea and cake in the bar. And next Friday, the bar will host a chocolate fountain from 7 p.m. onwards. Tickets for garden parties are starting to go on sale, so just a couple of shout-outs. The Union Garden Party is happening on Saturday, June 17th, in the grounds of Sydney Sussex College, with tickets priced £28 for members of the Union, £34 for student non-members, and £39 for non-student non-members. Tickets can be bought on their website. Finally, the Rag Charity Garden Party on June 15th was a fun occasion last year in Grantchester Meadows, with drinks and food going throughout the afternoon. Proceeds go to a number of charities which the committee has chosen to support this year, including the Cambridge RIP Crisis Centre, Jimmy's Cambridge and Food Cycle Cambridge, and an optional donation of £3 on top of the £19 ticket price can be added when paying through their website.
Yeah, many thanks, Emma. That garden party does sound really good.
Yes, it does.
I'd love to go to that. Anyway, we cut across to the city news now, starting with jobs, Alan.
Yes, Jack's Gelato is looking for full and part-time scoopers. If you want to be a scooper, contact Jack at jacksgelato.com. Afternoon Teas in King Street wants a permanent part-time cook to join its kitchen team. It will be about 20 to 30 hours a week, and it will include some weekends. Go and see Joe with your CV and include your telephone number, details of experience and interests. And Pint Shop is recruiting. Has a recruitment day on the 16th of May, so send your CV to them by then. Cambridge at pintshop.co.uk.
Okay, did you know that today is Asparagus Day? Well, this is going on until 4 p.m. at Burwash Manor in Barton. There's street food, demonstrations, tastings, and the entry is free.
Also today, in fact, from now until 8 p.m, La Latina Bustorante is open at last. Mm. We featured it, I think, last December, didn't we?
When we were setting up.
They're the Latin American food from a double-decker bus. Anyway, they're going to be next to the Darwin Farm Shop, which is at the east end of Newmarket Road. 8 Quay Waters is the official address. They have things like empanadas, arepas, tostones, and the famous prawns. And they'll be there tomorrow as well from 12 until 8 p.m.
And also today, the Cambridge Wine Fair. This is at the Grad Pad. That's the University Centre in Granter Place, which is at the bottom of Mill Lane. Food Park will be in attendance. Admission is £5 in advance, £12 on the door. You can try wines from 25p a sample. Today's times are 2 till 5 and 6 to 9, but we have just heard it's sold out for tonight. But it is also open for tomorrow from 3 till 6 p.m.
So if you're disappointed about not being able to go there tonight, why not go to the Blue Ball in Grantchester? Provenance Kitchen will be there tonight with a kitchen takeover. There'll be juicy steaks, lamb tacos, asparagus, flatbreads, oysters, all sorts of goodies.
Ooh, and tomorrow, Kath's Kitchen is popping up at the Garden Kitchen. That's on Mill Road, with macarons and other homemade cakey things.
There's a new bistro menu at the Cambridge Cookery School Cafe from today, £35 for 3 courses with a nice Italian feel to it.
And on the 17th of May at the Queen's Head in Newton, it's Buffalo Joe's. And on the 24th of May, Al Chili.
On 19th of May at the Architect in Castle Hill, My Persian Kitchen from 6:30 till 9:30. It's £24. There are 3 starters, a main course and a dessert. It's cash only, but you can book your place at Eventbrite.
And finally, looking further ahead, there's some bread baking courses. This is at the White Cottage Bakery, and they sell out pretty far in advance, but there are still some places for the 25th of June. That's for an Italian bread workshop. And then, on the 16th of July, there are places available for the sourdough workshop. Just see their website for details and booking.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Flavour. We'll be back on the 10th of June at noon. In our place on the 27th of May, when we would normally be appearing, will be Hunt and Darton, and you might remember their alternative pop-up cafe at the Eat Cambridge Festival a few years ago. Very entertaining. They'll be taking over the Cambridge 105 radio airways for 24 hours on the 10th of June, and they'll be including some food-related things to it, so it should be very entertaining. In the meantime, don't forget, you can have a listen to this programme again on the Cambridge 105 Radio podcast page or via iTunes from early next week. But from Matt and Ema and myself, thanks very much for listening. And until the 10th of June, and we hope it will be a bit warmer, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.